Hello and welcome back. This is Adam from Carpooling with Adam. I'm in my newer studio, which means it's better lighting and more quiet. So maybe we'll get to play Guess That Sound this episode, maybe not. Hopefully I don't have to do every episode twice like I did last time. I'm excited about today's chapter. Just to review, I'm walking through each chapter of Competing Against Luck by Clayton Christensen. And this is chapter 5 from part 2 of that book. And the chapter title is How to Hear What Your Customers Don't Say. To me, this is an underlying problem in the software and technology industry and business. Pretty common problem. So it speaks to problems at the industry level, as well as individual businesses and individuals in those businesses and how they handle these, understand their customers and the jobs and they need their customers need done or the progress they need to make, and therefore they hire you, buy your products or services. And I think this is a good way to tie a lot of things together. And I think you can talk about this at the big picture level and down at the very smallest detail level. I think it has an impact at all levels, I guess is what I'm trying to say in a really long, swervy roundabout way to get there. Sorry. But this is good. And this is what I've felt for decades in the industry. I had the inklings about this very early on when I was just beginning. And I still feel the same way today. And I think this is at the root of those issues and problems and why something has always felt off to me in this world and industry of software and technology. So cool. So the chapter heading dives right into how most companies want to, or at least say to, they are, or market as though they're closely connected to their customers and they're creating products and services that most customers want, right? That's kind of what everyone says. So when I hear that, okay, great, that doesn't tell me anything, right? There's a lot of red flags if everything is based around that high level and that generic of kind of statements or marketing campaigns, right? So he says, rarely though, is it when customers articulate their requirements accurately or completely. Now, why? Is this an indictment of customers? No. It's humanity, right? Our motivations as humans are complex. The reasons why we purchase things or how we purchase things, also complex and nuanced. And even elaborate and complicated, and they're not always the best at describing it, right? And so I think you have to have the smarts to ask the right questions and the intelligence and the ears to listen and understand and interpret what they're saying, because you can't take it always at face value. And they're not always going to be able to describe it to you. So you have to kind of listen for those things. I'd say journalistic, but that doesn't mean the same thing anymore. And so I don't like using that term as it, you know, currently plays out in modern world today. But I think you understand the idea I'm getting at. So you've got to get to the bottom of that. And because we've been talking about jobs to be done, continuing this context of hiring and firing. So what are they hiring you to do? And what are they firing in order to hire you? Right? What trade-off? Oh, great. What trade-offs are they making? And again, going back to understanding functional, emotional, and social dimensions of their desire for progress. And what's preventing them? What's getting in their way? And so I like the way he describes it. He says it better than me. I said journalism, but he says part sleuth, part documentary filmmaker. That's awesome. And if you think about those two things, you're digging into the details. You're digging into the thoroughness. It takes a lot of patience. It takes a lot more effort. It takes a longer time. It takes a lot more investment to be a sleuth or a documentary film worker, filmmaker, than just someone who can do a quick superficial read of something and put a headline out, right? And you have to do this in order to get at what you're really after. So let's dive into the chapter takeaways. And there's a lot, but I think it's good because in reading this earlier, it hits on a lot of good topics. He does go through like a sample interview, and not a sample, but I think it's an actual interview he did with somebody, almost like in script form. Asking the questions and someone really digging in and trying to understand and hear what the customer isn't saying, what they're not telling you. A lot of good insight in that, and it's worth trying to get at. Okay, so the first takeaway is getting at their real job to be done is challenging. It's hard. And they can't always articulate what they want. So now you can see, if you understand that, you understand the danger of only parroting what customers say to your product development groups or your engineering teams. You can see how that gets dangerous, because you're inherently missing stuff, and that it's not smooth sailing from there. So. That has ripple effects throughout the entire organization. And I seriously mean that. I'm not just trying to exaggerate or be dramatic. There are ripple effects throughout the entire organization. And if I put it together in my head, I'll give some examples. And they're going to tell you that they know what they want. And if you just go based on that, you're going to miss stuff. And sometimes they will say and do things that contradict each other. And the actions they take may not align with what they've just told you. And then you'd be scratching your head. Right? So it's really getting out of the game or jumping into things prematurely to just go with what they initially just described to you and not dig any deeper. And then often, especially in today's world of data and analytics and AI, right? You know, everybody's using all of those terms and buzzwords. And what I and others have learned as we've talked about this together is, even if you have seemingly objective data, right, it can still be misleading. It's funny how many people take action on, and he uses the word seemingly. So it's, whether it's seemingly objective or it is objective, it still can be misleading, right? I don't think the point so much there is that somebody's intentionally being misleading with their objective data, but that it can be misleading either way. And so just, and often the, even though having all this data available doesn't mean people are more intelligent and informed. It's funny that this isn't as popular anymore, but it's still out there. The term business intelligence, right? I remember when it first came out, there was a lot of hype around that term, and we've got a business intelligence group now, and so we're gonna make data-driven decisions, and on and on and on. And then when it came to practice, because I'd been in the reporting and database world, I looked at it and was like, well, that's just the same thing we've already been doing. But all right, whatever. It's got a new marketing spin on it. So it's selling more products in the market. Great. But does it really mean your business is behaving more intelligently? Maybe. Excuse me. Maybe not. Dang it. I thought we were getting better with the coughing thing. I guess I'm still not talking out loud enough. And I'm going to put the water over here so I don't keep reaching across the microphone to grab it and blocking my noise. All right. So think of this less as a podcast and more of you're just having a chat with me. That's my excuse for the lower levels of professionalism. Okay. And so I think something that he points out to sort of help you decipher this or know the difference is he calls relying on the big hire versus the little hire. Right? So the big hires, when they actually buy a product, they make that purchase, they sign a contract, they pay an invoice. But you're neglecting the little hire, what the customer actually does with what they've purchased. Right? Because shelling out the money is obviously a big deal. And it's taking something from them that maybe they have to spend or they don't, right? And I see all kinds of sales pitches trying to work around that. But do you know the difference between the little hires? Do you know what they're actually, when they're actually using it? And the big hire, you know, keeping things at the big and the large scale kind of gives the false sense of security and the illusion that, well, we've solved their problem, boom, done. They've made the purchase and they're on their way on the yellow brick road, happily skipping along. But you don't know that, right? And the only way you're going to know that is focusing on the little hires and understanding how they actually use it and see what's going on. And that's going to confirm that it's actually doing the job that they need it to. And then the next point I think is an important one. And you have to understand that before customers hire a new product, they're going to have to fire something, right? It's very rare that people are like, wow, we've got all this disposable income and we're just looking for something to blow it on. And hey, you happen to come along, so let's do it. No, that's hardly ever the case. So, They're going to make some sacrifices to hire your product or your service, and to do that, yeah, they're going to make some sacrifices. They're going to have to fire something. So adding you to the list means something else has to come off the list. That's just the reality for everyone. That's even at an individual level, right? I don't have unlimited funds and time and energy, so I have to make some choices. And spending money and effort on something means something else isn't getting those things spent on it, right? Of course, this is related to the opportunity cost, if you're familiar with that term. And you have to think about that. You have to consider it. And he points out that most companies don't do it enough. And I would agree in my experience. Because again, this is more effort. It's digging deeper. It's being a sleuth and a film and a documentary maker. Gosh, this is stupid how this just snowballs. And so the next point is, in order to be better at hearing what the customer doesn't say or can't say, right? Either could be the case. If you think about what that's going to take, is a quick sales call going to do that? Maybe in microdoses, right? But that just means there's going to have to be a lot of them. If your interaction is going to lunch with somebody, are you just talking about golf for 2 hours, or are you digging in? I mean, I'm not knocking that, but understand that that's one part. That's a key part, and it's one part. But taking the time to really dive in with customers is a very big part, equally if not more important. And so it requires investment, right? Careful interaction and observation on your part. I had a job where I was like a territory account manager for the northernmost part of my state. And so I was going to all kinds of different customers, which were different businesses. Most of the time I was visiting them to deliver important documents and things that they had requested. But my favorite time is when, and often I was dealing with the business owner themselves or a manager or somebody like that. And I would show a little curiosity in understanding their business, and they would love to take me back. One customer was a company that makes metal springs, right? And I'd always just come into the office, made small talk, gave them the stuff, have a nice day, and, you know, just small talk, chit-chat, and then be on my way to my next customer because I had several stops to make that day. Well, one day, I started asking questions about his business. Oh, so, okay, so you make springs, you know, does it matter how big and how small? And he lit right up and was like, well, come back in. He took me through the shop and his facility and explained it and showed me some of the machines working, and then they actually spun the wire into springs and clipped it off. And those are my favorite times interacting with a customer, because I understood not just them better, but their whole business and what they did and how excited they were about it, or what their passion was about it, how they got into that business, which were often very interesting, colorful stories. So I just love that aspect. And I didn't get to do enough, obviously, because they had a business to run. And, you know, my transactions with them are not supposed to take a long time, generally. So when those rare chances, when I got to actually talk to them about it, and, you know, when I'm in college taking a marketing class, and one of my customers is a marketing firm, I sort of now all of a sudden I had some context. Oh, well, hey, what do you do with customers like this? And do you help them with this? And do you, and he would, you know, they would like all of a sudden open up and be happy to sit down and chat with me for a few minutes. So it was really cool and a really good experience for me, and very, very educational for me, and laid a very good foundation for my life and career and my experience to this day. I can see how I benefited greatly from that. So it was awesome. So if I'm going to offer products and services, that's the kind of interaction I need to have if I really, really want to meet their needs effectively. And being able to hear what they're not saying, often that would give me insight that they wouldn't necessarily say to me. But then when I had a meeting with a VP or an executive and they were asking me about a specific customer, I had a lot more context on them and could be more useful in often the business decisions regarding that particular customer. And doing this, he calls this, you have to do this with a beginner's mind, and is what he calls it. And having that mindset helps avoid ongoing assumptions that could prematurely filter out critical information. That's that last sentence I love that. Because I have seen all too often where there's a lot of subject matter experts involved in the business and telling me excuse me, what customers need or what they want the software to do. They can't see beyond their own expertise. Does that make sense? And the solutions they prescribed, strangely, always happen to follow within those tight boundaries and focus that I knew was their area of expertise. And they had a harder time seeing outside of that. And I've seen in my work experience where those people, even in different contexts, will recommend the same kind of solutions over and over and over, right? Maybe it's the same thing just on a different platform. Maybe it's the same thing just using a different technology stack or different mix. Or it's just funny how often that happens. And it's a real challenge for them to see outside that. And you're going to miss stuff. That's the consequences. You're going to miss stuff if you can't see outside that. So maybe a little humility and approach things with a beginner's mindset instead of, well, I'm the expert here, and so I know what I'm talking about. And, you know, then I have to be the guy that says, well, you've been saying the same thing, though, for 15 years, and it hasn't necessarily garnered the best results. So, you know, maybe we ought to think outside the box here. Well, you know, no, you, how dare you challenge my expertise, my PhD or whatever qualifications they feel they have. So I've run into that firsthand many times. And they do, in fact, miss stuff. And then when you try and point out what they're missing, they don't respond to it well, right? So create some real blind spots that has some pain associated with it and some consequences. And then I like this next part. He talks about storyboard. A lot of people use this term in different contexts, but he talks about developing a full understanding of the job by assembling a storyboard that describes in rich detail the customer's circumstances, moments of struggle, imperfect experiences, and corresponding frustrations. Now, does that sound like a persona or a use case? It does not, right? It's way bigger and deeper than that. So I think you're leaving a lot of things on the table if you have too narrow of a focus. And if you think about a storyboard, what is it? Is it a single column of maybe cards or tabs or post-it notes? Absolutely not, right? Storyboards are bigger, broader, multiple lines and shapes and things intersecting. If you think of those people who do visual storyboards now, that you know, that will on a whiteboard with a marker and draw them freehand as someone's talking or telling a story or explaining a concept, rarely do those fall in two or three single columns of cards or notes, right? It's a little more squirrely than that. And it brings in this aspect over here and this aspect over here visually, right? You can imagine much more larger, broader, more complex. There's so much good detailed information in there that's so useful to you. And then as part of that storyboard, he continues, it's critically important to understand, his words are so awesome, the forces that compel change to a new solution, including the push of the unsatisfied job itself and the pull of the new solution. Understanding those dynamics, what's pushing this, what's the pull, right? What are we pulling them towards? What about the solution is drawing them in and pushing them away from the one that's not meeting their needs currently, right? You got to understand those two dynamics that are trying to counteract one another. And then it's also critical to understand the forces opposing any change, including inertia caused by current habits and the anxiety about a new one, right? That's a human factor. I think I've seen a lot of times where people try and dismiss that or ignore it or pretend it doesn't exist. But again, this is a world full of humans, and how we've always done it is a very powerful force. And anxiousness about doing something new or doing things different, also very, very powerful force in humans. And those, you got to acknowledge that those things exist and understand why they do. Are you always going to be able to mitigate them to the fullest degree? Absolutely not. There are some things, there are certain markets, that technology is a new player in. And the fact that the people in that world may not be familiar with technology and have that learning curve, it's kind of hard to get around that, right? At some point, nearly everyone has had to accept or get comfortable with technology in some degree or another, right? That's just the world we're in now. But trying to help someone who's not comfortable with a mouse or a particular user interface, again, is it a problem with them being new to technology, or is it is your interface crappy, right? It could be either of those or both. So it's important that you dig into that and understand that. And if you can, find ways that you can help, right? There's certain things you may not be able to help with, but maybe there's opportunities or possibilities or innovations out there that you could offer that would help. I'm trying to think. I had thought I had an example there, but it just left me. All right, maybe it'll come back. So the next point is, so if the forces opposing this change are strong, it's kind of said what I just said. You can often innovate the experiences you provide in a way that mitigates them, or create new experiences that minimize the anxiety of moving to something new, right? Maybe you're in a space where customers are trying to get multiple different and disparate technologies to communicate and talk with one another. That's a hard obstacle for them to overcome, right? So if there's some way you can help with that, it could be a real opportunity for innovation for you and for something you can offer that helps them make progress and makes it easier on them to transition to it. I'm just thinking of all the ways this is misapplied, and things are too quickly written off as, well, that's just a training issue, or that's just an education issue, or, well, that's the problem with that vendor, that's not us. Maybe, but you have to also be willing to consider, maybe not. Maybe you can or you should address that for your sake, for their sake, for everyone's sake, right? You got to explore those options. Got to be willing to investigate them. And if you're in a business executive, don't put your team in a position where they can't, right? Because you want them to be able to dig into this stuff. But if you put so many external pressures and constraints on them that they don't feel like they can, that's on you, not them. All right. Oh, there was something. There was a good example here I wanted to make. That it came to my mind as I was reading through this earlier, and now it's gone. Maybe just in general, this is something else I thought of that I forgot to mention earlier. Sometimes, as we've talked about this, I'm sure you're feeling the weight of it. It's heavy. I'm not trying to sell it as anything lighter than it is. One of the avenues I see a lot of organizations lean on is that they think the answer is better requirements. Oh, that's right. It was this one. What was the one? Oh. It was earlier on, this tied in. Oh, customers not being able to articulate what they want, right? You're going to hear this at some point or another, or all the time, if you're like me, that it's in the requirements, right? Well, if we accept up front the premise that customers may or may not be able to articulate that to us, then it's not. It's not in the requirements. It's not going to be there. As much as you want it to be, as much as you need it to be, a robust requirements gathering documentation process, not going to solve the issue. But instead, all the other things that we talked about will. All right. Ugh. Newly discovered. Gosh sakes. Tangential problem to this coughing is me drinking water to help. That means I may have to end this earlier and run to the restroom. I'm just kidding. I got time. I'm okay. I'm a big boy. I know how to hold it. All right. Okay. Well, sorry. No more pauses. Let me just keep going on to the questions for leaders. And maybe that'll spark some other examples that I've been trying to remember. Okay. So questions. So ask yourself, what evidence do you have that you've clearly understood your customers' jobs? Do your customers' actions correspond to what they tell you they want? Do you have evidence that your customers make the little hire and big hire? You got to ask those questions. And if you don't, then find out. Another dynamic or twist on this that I've seen is, you know, the higher up you go in an organization, they're going to be talking big hire. And then when I get to actually talk to the end users, I find out a whole lot of stuff that's a disconnect and a contradiction and maybe even in conflict with what the big hire by the big person thinks they're paying for and what the actual problem is or what the end user experience is. And most organizations are going to be some level of disconnect there, right? You got to know or be able to recognize when it's there and then dig in. What's the disconnect, right? Was the guy in finance just looking for the lowest price to sign the check for? Quite possibly. And now he's just purchased a horrible solution for the end users. How long do you think your contract with them is going to last? Probably not very long term, right? They're less likely to sign again when it comes time for a renewal if all they've heard is nothing but complaints from the users of the system. Some cases they maybe don't care. There are other red flags there, but I wouldn't necessarily hang my hat on, well, I don't care. The VP is still the one signing the check. Cool. There's a whole lot of collateral damage there happening that you're choosing to ignore or you don't want to see. So, but I promise you it's there if that's the case. And maybe you're never going to hear about it and you don't care. But there are consequences when that happens in an organization. And guess what? When they're talking to their buddies who are in this colleagues in the same company or outside and they go to some industry expo and they're all having a beer together at the end of the day, they're going to get to talking. Oh, yeah. Oh, we're looking for a new solution. Oh, don't get the one we have. It's a major pain in the butt to use. And now you've just lost a potential new customer and potentially a big one. Yikes, right? So It's not enough that the VP signs the check every year. If the end users are having a horrible experience, it will be to your detriment at some point. Oh my goodness. Wow. I don't know what's going on. Maybe the universe is trying to shut me up. Okay. Can you tell a complete story? It doesn't say, can you give an elevator speech or a quick pitch about how your customers go from a circumstance of struggle to firing their current solution and ultimately hiring yours? See, there's a story there, right? Those aren't just key bullet points or stepping stones. There's an actual story around that. And again, in parentheses, understanding the big and little hires. And where are the gaps in your storyboard? And what do you do when you find gaps? You just, we acknowledge we have these five gaps in the story, but we're going to move ahead. Maybe that's a good idea. Maybe not. It's worth knowing what you're missing and filling them in. Then you've got an even more complete story. And again, that ends up in a much better result. All right, and then the final question for leaders, what are the forces that impede potential customers from hiring your product, and how could you innovate the experiences surrounding your product to overcome those forces? This one's really tricky because some people will hear that and interpret that as, well, that requires adopting our technology, requires that our customers pay another vendor an additional fee for them to implement this a certain piece for them, right? And so on the surface, and I know some people have done this, they'll say, okay, well then we'll just give it to them for free. That makes the sell easier, but is it really helping the customer? Not always. And most of the time, no. So just because they don't want to pay somebody else for it, and so you give it to them for free, in and of itself is not a solution to the customer's problem. And makes the sell easier, makes the big hire easier, but does nothing for all the little hires. So you got to be careful of that. I'm trying to think of any other examples. And innovate the experiences surrounding your product, right? That word experience is interesting. That implies you have a better understanding. You understand that. What is their experience? Not just with your product, but how does it impact their whole ecosystem, right? Does your product now have adverse or positive impacts on some of the other products they have to use that aren't from you? Does it cause ripple effects for them that they now have to mitigate and manage that they didn't have to before, right? It's hard. You don't know that from high-level superficial conversations. You have to worry about, as it's put in the book, the little hires. And understand, okay, well, they've purchased this. Does that make something else obsolete? And if so, is there anyone else relying on that outside this immediate group that now is at a disadvantage, right? It can get complicated really quickly in some organizations in certain industries where there's a lot of layers and a lot of players in the same space all trying to make something very complex work for a customer. I use the term ecosystem. I like that because they all do have impact on one another. And all impact the different dynamics with one another in some way or another. And so it's a really good idea to know that and understand that. And if you can address it, great. If not, understand why you can't, and make sure you can't. You're not saying you can't just because you don't want to. Because you could be missing a real opportunity there. And I see this come into play a lot, where if everything in your organization is date and timeline driven, well, then you exclude all these types of decisions and possibilities, right? Because most of the time, if you're trying to get something shipped and out the door, and anyone or anything that comes to you and says, well, we've got this important factor, but it's going to take more time, well, the answer is immediately always no, right? If you're strictly timeline focused and have no sense of prioritization and all these other things that I've been talking about in this book, from this book, you're going to miss stuff, and you're going to leave yourself, you're going to carve yourself out of opportunities that you could potentially own, and areas that you could really help customers make progress and be a good thing for you and for them, you know, both. But because you're only making the decision based on time frames, you're going to miss those opportunities. One of the consequences of doing that, because I could talk about this for a long time, and whoa, I've already gone long and coughed through half it, so I'm wrapping up here. Don't worry. You don't want to exclude yourself from making your own innovations and progress and advances, and strictly making all decisions based on time frames inherently does that. It just does. All right, that's enough. I've gone on longer than normal, and oh geez, almost twice as long. But lots of really good content in this chapter, and one of my favorites, and certainly one that I resonate most with. Thanks for listening. If you want to interact with me, please feel free to do so. Ask me questions, challenge me, challenge my perspective, my understanding. That's why I'm doing this, because I'm challenging myself. And unfortunately, I'm sorry, there's no guess what sound that was this episode, other than my horrible coughing. And for some reason, wearing my reader glasses is causing me sinus issues. So thanks for sticking it out with me through this mess. Hope you have a good day, and we'll talk again soon. Bye.